Before we begin, we'd like to ask a favor. If you could take a moment to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, we'd really appreciate it. We're told it helps the show find new listeners. Thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to the B&B podcast. This is the third episode of series two. In this series, we invite writers to read from their work and discuss the short story form, their writing process, how they got published, and what they're reading. The B&B podcast is a project from Brook Lane Bookshop. I'm Kate Ellis, and this is my co-host, Peter J. Coles.
Hello.
Hi there. Today, we are speaking with Imogen Fox, who was the first prize winner in the Brook Lane Bookshop Short Story Prize 2022.
Imogen Fox is a fiction writer from Manchester. She has an MA in Creative and Life Writing from Goldsmiths, University of London, where her short story, The Swimming Pool, won the 2022 Pat Kavanagh Prize. She's now working on developing the short story into a full-length novel.
Okay, so we're here today in Dalston with Imogen Fox, who won our short story prize last year. Hello, Imogen. Thank you so much for making the journey here this evening.
It's my pleasure. It's very exciting.
I'm glad. I'm excited too.
Good.
We're going to begin the episode with Imogen reading an excerpt from Missy Starling. Are you ready?
Yes, I'm ready. I'm going to do the same preface that I like to do, which is that the narrator of this story is from Florida, and I am not. And I'd just like everyone to imagine that I'm speaking in a flawless American accent. If I were the kind of person who signed non-disclosure agreements and then broke them, I guess I'd start like this. I had all but given up on finding the place. I'd been worrying that the snow and the barely sleeping and the stumbling out of motels into my car for yet another stretch of driving around Minnesota had been for nothing. Around midnight, some kind of highway hypnosis had taken over, and I'd started to have visions of my frozen corpse being chiseled out of my car in the morning. But then I saw it. Or rather, I saw the walls. Normal people don't need walls that high, especially people in the middle of nowhere. Even so, I wasn't certain until my headlights floodlit the blue mailbox. The blue mailbox with a bird on top. Not just any bird, a starling. She'd posted a picture of it last spring. I was one of the 5 million people who'd liked it. It was the perfect spot. Off-grid, no reception for miles, and the snow, falling, settling, glittering like shattered glass, would keep most people off the roads. It had been hours since I'd seen another car. I parked around the north side of the wall, so my car wouldn't be visible from the road. Had to give myself a little pep talk before venturing out into the snow. I'm a child of the South, Florida to be exact. Didn't see snow in real life before I took my daughter up to visit the University of Pennsylvania. I said it was like cold sand and she laughed at me. Emily's at UPenn now, full scholarship. That's the Ivy League one. Some people get confused, so I always like to clarify. It had been days since I'd had real hope of finding the house, so I had to remind myself of the plan and give myself a pat on the back for getting here. Self-esteem is really important, and when you don't have someone else to thank you, sometimes you've got to thank yourself. I'd arrived, I was at the house, and now it was just a matter of fiddling with the electricity box and scaling the wall. I'm making it sound simpler than it was. I guess I'm trying to sound impressive. Now the crazy thing is that the back door was unlocked. What kind of person has 10-foot walls surrounding their property, cameras and alarms and all sorts, but doesn't lock their back door? That's what happens when a celebrity wants to act like a normal person. They abandon their security team and they forget that normal people check their back doors. It's pretty adorable when you think about it. It was maybe 1 a.m. and the house was not dead quiet, sleep quiet. Like the walls themselves were breathing deeply. Trying to buy myself some time meant sacrifices. Killing the electricity meant the house was slowly leaching its heat. You could practically feel the cold air sucking it out. I knew I had to move fast, but it's not like there was memorabilia or anything to distract me. I knew her Grammys weren't there. She keeps them in her house in Malibu. Same with platinum albums, old guitars, that dress she wore to the Oscars when she wrote that song for that superhero film. None of it was here. That's the point of this house. Come November, I'm heading north, back to where I can be myself. That's the lyric. People don't pay enough attention to lyrics. If they did, there'd be a lot more people like me.
Thank you so much for reading. It reminded me quite how funny the story is and how distinct the voice.
It's what I was going for. I kind of I can't do serious trousers. It's like, I'm glad that people find it funny, because it is kind of an inevitability with stuff that I write, is that someone's got to crack a joke or ease the tension or something, because I think partly because of how I was raised. My mum had a theatre company. It was her and my godmother as this kind of comedy duo doing spoofs and stuff. And so we've just, as a family, we just like making each other laugh and being funny. And we like to say, not in a kind of, not in a bad way, but just that humour is like currency. Mm-hmm. I like writing things that acknowledge that even very dark stuff is still funny.
I think the darker the funnier.
Yeah.
Quite often. Would you mind describing the story for the listeners? Give as much away as you feel is appropriate.
So it started when I became aware that there is a section of the internet that is convinced that Taylor Swift is secretly gay. And depending on which kind of faction within the faction you belong to, she has been conducting a long-term secret affair, possibly with Karlie Kloss, possibly with Diana Agron, possibly with whoever. But it's something that they are very dedicated about, and, you know, spend all of this time analysing posts that she makes or lyrics in her songs, and thinking about, you know, the subtext and unpacking things. It's like a close reading of every move she makes, which just was very interesting to me, because it was kind of like, on the one hand, I think it's a very human thing, you know, just like you look at, I'm going to sound so wanky if I'm quoting Kant, but it's...
You've already talked about Taylor Swift. I think it's okay. Yeah.
Okay, so we're balancing.
Yeah.
But he's got this thing about... I think it's Kant. I'm really going to... Anyway, whatever. Let's say it's Kant and I can be fact-checked. Says this thing about how, like, the stars are just random configurations, but we project constellations onto them. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, tell ourselves stories about those constellations, and then we have horoscopes, and then we have, not that Kant talks about horoscopes, but you see what I mean. It's a very human thing on one level to try and unpick meaning from art, and in some ways, like, the life of a celebrity is just one long piece of performance art. Mm-hmm. But then also there's something very weird about it, that you're like dedicating so much of your time to convincing yourself and other people that someone you really like and admire is lying to you and to the world in a very like dedicated way. So it just made me think, what is it that these people want to happen? Like, what's a win? What, you know, and trying to sort of follow that to the logical conclusion of, like, if you're convinced this is the case, and if you're a little bit unhinged, what do you do next? Because there are people who just know where she is at all times and track her private jet. And mm-hmm. So that's kind of how it started, is just kind of a sort of thought experiment of, let's say there's a person who is desperate to find out the truth, where they think that this singer is secretly gay and in a secret relationship with another celebrity. What would they do to prove that if for some reason they need proof?
So that brings us to the question. So the main character, Donna.
Yes.
She's a very strong character. She's and she's quite cynical, and she wants to be in control all the time, but then eventually everything just unravels for her. I don't think that's a spoiler. So how did you come up with Donna specifically? Is she based on someone you found on the internet, or collection of people?
No, not even. It's one of those... It's interesting that you think that she's cynical, because in my head there's something sort of rosy about the way she views the world. It's... So that, yeah, that's very interesting, because I think she's sort of... Yeah, I can't think who she's based on. I think it's kind of like you start writing in a particular voice and the character kind of comes to meet the voice. And I think also part of it is I needed there to be some kind of personal reason driving what she's doing. And because I also felt like there was a danger of being almost like being something sort of cheap or sort of, I don't know, about it being like a gay person or a queer person who needs to prove that there's a queer celebrity. Because I don't think most people are approaching it like that. And also it just, yeah, there was something that made me quite uncomfortable about the idea of like, oh yeah, there's this deranged queer person breaking into someone's house. Because I think it just plays into a lot of harmful tropes. And so, and also I think I just thought it was funny to have a sort of very... on the one hand, very normal seeming middle-aged woman have this streak of like steel determination and darkness running through her, but she thinks she's doing it in the name of love.
No, she that definitely comes across, this sense of that she's got like a divine purpose inside of her that she's trying, that is the right thing for her to break into this celebrity's house and well, I won't spoil it, but you know, read the story. But it's, yeah, no, it definitely comes across that she truly believes what she thinks is correct. Although she does start to have doubts, doesn't she? Little tiny moments of doubt creep in.
Yeah. I mean, I also think that it's kind of inspired by like a lot of those types of conspiracy theories that grip people and you kind of just get swept in the web of something. And so it's also part of like, yeah, if you have this committed belief, how does that get unpicked and how do you react? Because I don't think there's a lot of cases where someone's core belief gets undermined and they thank you for it.
That's very true. Did you set it in America because, I don't know, I don't know if it's a cultural thing or whatever, but it seems like a lot of the conspiracy theories, a lot of that fanaticism is coming from America.
Part of it being set in America is because, you know, you have like QAnon and sort of, yeah, this strain of conspiracy theories that do seem to... I don't know if they have like uniquely more of a hold, but maybe it's just that like the possibility of it tipping over into violence feels much more present there. And also because I thought, in my head, you know, Missy Starling is meant to be this sort of all-American, really quintessentially girl next door kind of character. And so because she felt very American, I kind of thought, well, it's much more convenient to get to her if you're in the same country.
I think so. The mention of violence there leads me quite nicely onto my next question, which is that you do, there's a hammer early on in the story.
Yes.
And therefore there are many sort of quite nasty directions the story could go in.
Yeah.
I wondered how many of those versions you wrote, or what is the current ending the only one?
No, definitely not. And actually I'm indebted to... a lot of people, but definitely Claire Fisher, who was my tutor when I was at Goldsmiths. And also the feedback that I got on this when I wrote it while I was doing my MA, of basically saying, I think essentially it's one of those kill your darlings things. I got too attached to the line, the problem you have once you throw a hammer is that you no longer have a hammer.
Oh, I kind of wish that was still in.
Yeah, but in some ways that became like, yeah, actually a kind of a symbol of the whole problem of the original ending to the story. Mm-hmm. Is she's got to keep the hammer. If she loses the hammer, you lose all of the tension. Mm-hmm. So it turned not super violent, but mildly violent, like halfway through in the first draft. So part of the redraft process was kind of realizing that doesn't work. and you have to kind of keep the hammer in her hand for as long as possible. Otherwise, yeah, everything falls apart and it just feels, oh, well, I know what's going to happen now.
Yes, that's a really interesting point, because her keeping that hammer means that the tension is there all the way through the short story. And what I also think is interesting is that she discovers her darker side as she goes through. This is what I felt anyway. Did you feel like that was happening to her as she was going through? Like she discovered how maybe violent she could be?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a sort of twofold thing. Is I wanted the reader to learn that there's this darker side running through her. And also I think, yeah, she becomes aware of what she's capable of. Because again, it's like you start out with this thing of, no, I'm fighting for truth and justice over here. You know, I'm doing the noble thing. And it's not just that I'm here for the right reasons, but actually ultimately she's going to be grateful that I am breaking her out of this cage. It's then this discovery of like, if you hit a wall and the person is not grateful and is not kind of matching your expectations and things aren't going the way you thought they would, then there is this kind of, particularly because we have this sort of parallel storyline with her daughter, which again, it's like, I have done so much for you and you are now no longer responding the way that I want you to. So in both cases, it's kind of like, if you have something that you feel like ought to be under your control and it suddenly isn't, what comes out of you in response to that situation?
I just have one more question regarding the hammer. So it's America.
Yeah.
Obviously, there's a big gun problem.
Yeah.
You choose a hammer, not a gun. And I wondered why. I think the hammer works, but I wondered if you could explain why you chose a hammer, not a gun.
I think ultimately it was about intimacy. And it was also, I suppose it was partially inspired by my great grandmother who.
Okay.
When I asked this question, I was like, okay.
Here we go.
But obviously she died before I was born. So this is all coming second, third hand. But my great uncle was apparently a very sweet man. But a bit weedy, and he got broken up with by a girl, and her brothers for some reason beat him up in response or something. So then my great grandmother, who my dad referred to as Nanny Flower, because she called everyone Flower, so she's Nanny Flower. Nanny Flower goes round to these brothers' house with a hammer handle in her bag and beats them up.
Wow. Okay.
Blimey.
So I think part of it was just that story has really stayed with me. So part of it was that, of just that nice contrast of little Nanny Flower with the hammer handle in her bag. And part of it was, just that intimacy of like gun you can hold from across the room. Whereas a hammer, you've got to get up close to someone. And I think it's also a kind of, because it's like a household item. Again, it's part of Donna's narrative of herself. Of it's like, well, it's not like I came there with a gun. You know, I came here with a hammer. I came here with a tool for fixing things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm so glad I asked that question. Yeah. I thought, is that a dumb question? But no, I'm really glad I got to learn about Nanny Flower.
Was Nanny Flower's hammer also purple?
I don't believe so, but I don't know.
I love that detail of it being purple. That's such a mum thing, I think, to have a purple hammer. I don't know why.
The BLB podcast is brought to you by Brick Lane Bookshop. As a thank you for listening to us talk about short stories, we're offering all listeners a 10% discount. Just use the code BLBPOD, that's BLBPOD, for a 10% discount off any purchase at bricklanebookshop.org.
Talking about that made me wonder even more about the rest of Donna's life.
Mm.
Because she's so fixated on what she wants to be true and then getting in touch with her daughter. All you hear is this desperation. It's like, is there anything good in her life? Has she got anyone to talk to ever? Do you know?
I don't know that I think I sort of imagined it as like, it's not that she has no one, it's just that she's decided what's important. So everything else, even if someone's trying to connect with her, it's like it's not enough. It's like, if you're not in the category of things I've decided to care about, then you are insufficient. So I didn't imagine her totally isolated, but I sort of imagined this kind of quiet superiority, as she feels like there's almost something more spiritual about her life and the things she cares about compared to other people who are in her community.
I wanted to ask, so Miss Darling is a rare thing. It's a short story that is funny, and that's quite rare. It's quite a rare thing. Did you know it was funny as you were writing it? Are you aware of the humor, or is it something that you sort of are told after the fact?
I think a bit of both. I think in some ways you never know if something's, like, I know it if it's amusing me, but in some ways funny, I don't know if I believe this, but I feel like funny is a community activity. So funny, it requires a reader. So in some ways you can never know if something's funny until it's shared. But I definitely, because I used to have a kind of definitely a wrong and an ill-founded sort of prejudice against short stories. So I'm very new to the party, because I used to think, oh yeah, well, a short story is, you know, a very sad collection of pages where someone probably dies, and it's usually a mum, and it ends just when it's getting good. And that's what a short story is. And then obviously doing my MA was just an exercise in that being disproved. Particularly George Saunders was a big one, of reading his collection of short stories. And it's like, oh, this is weird. Oh, this is weird. And it's funny. And it's, and it's not kind of keeping itself in a box. And so, I think that was really useful. And also, like Carmen Maria Machado, I love so much. And, you know, her doing things where it's like I'm going to get this mixed up, because I think she does this. Does she do this like in the Dream House? And then she also does it in,
Her Body, Another Party.
Yeah, I feel like in Her Body, Another Party, there's a story that's like a collection of episode summaries.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. And is that the Star Trek one or the X-Files one? And then isn't there also something in Dream House which has like SVU episodes?
Yeah. It's like one of those crime series ones.
Yeah.
That's in Her Party, Another... No, Her Body, Another Party.
Is the SVU one?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Okay.
We're big Machado fans on this podcast, yeah. And I think she's probably the most talked about subject on the whole thing. And we tried to get her, and she wouldn't come on.
Really?
One day.
Aww.
She was busy.
She's in demand, isn't she?
Yeah, I bet.
To be honest, I don't think she'd come to Dalston of an evening. No.
Maybe one.
I mean, one day, maybe. That would be my dream come true.
But just what, you know, what she does with the short story form and with all forms, you know, of just playing around with it and not having it be one thing. That made a difference. And also, you know, I think there's a little bit of Fargo, not a lot. I don't have a wood chipper, but that's sort of, it definitely was in my head putting this together and thinking about sort of darkness and funny things. And it's like, I do want it to be in Minnesota. I love a Minnesota accent.
The Fargo reference makes a lot of sense. Bleak, snowy, lonely landscapes and one middle-aged woman out there in an anorak.
With a hammer. With a hammer, not a gun.
Yeah.
Very true.
I really liked how honest you were about not liking short stories. And you've picked a couple of my favourite writers that changed your mind. But was it after reading them that you began writing them? Are you that fresh to the game, the short story world?
I am pretty fresh. I think my first short story was in 2019. Mm-hmm. which, but I definitely hadn't read a lot back then. And it was, it wasn't just George Saunders and Carmen Maria Machado, but they were definitely the ones where I was like, you can do this.
Yeah, they do sort of bend your mind, don't they?
Yeah, yeah. Because with some of them, you think, this is so great, but I don't want to do that. As in, you know, like you sort of traditional, I suppose, short story, you know, reading like your John Cheevers or your Raymond Carvers. Mm-hmm. And it's not that it's bad. It's not that it doesn't resonate. It's just that it's not the kind of thing that I was then like, and I want to replicate that.
They don't seem to be having a lot of fun, do they?
That's
the main difference.
This is my problem is people not having fun and people not talking like people. I mean, I know that Donna and Missy are not like your prototypical people off the street, but I feel like sometimes there's sort of dialogue that happens that feels very disjointed. And I know that that is in some ways how people talk and it just looks odd on the page. But sometimes I do just think, yeah, but you wouldn't say that.
Yeah.
Also, it's not funny.
No, reading a Carver collection is not an amusing experience.
Yeah.
It's like quite kind of grim and sort of soaked in booze, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm so glad we've got other voices now. I love those stories, but I am glad there's some other voices now coming through. Just moving on, it's the inevitable question on the short story podcast. But I understand you're working on a novel.
I am,
based on a short story you wrote that won the Kavanagh Prize. Is that right?
That is right.
Called The Swimmer.
Called The Swimming Pool.
See, I've gone back to short. Who's the
gone
swimmer?
Back to Cheever.
Gone back to Cheever. Yeah. That is a very good short story.
It is a good short story.
The Swimming Pool.
Yes.
And you're working on this. Do you have an agent or is it just something you're working on and then hope to?
So I have, this is what's very exciting about winning a short story prize is that in the aftermath of that, you then do have agents who want to read your work. It's very exciting. So I don't have an agent because I want to kind of show them a full thing, which is, I'm looking at the end of March, I think, for having something to show people, which I'm saying now, and so I have to do it. But
this will come out at the end of March.
Yeah.
So okay.
By the time this comes out, hopefully.
I will have sent an email. this is part of what was so great about doing the MA at Goldsmiths was that I was able to wear a lot of hats and do a lot of things that I was interested in. So, you know, of the short stories that I've written, there's ones that are almost like, there's like crime elements and there's, you know, this little weirdo, and there's I've written a kind of magical realism one about two girls that swap hands when they're kids, because I'm interested in all of those different things. And so part of wanting the full thing was kind of about just making sure that people know what they're getting into, because I'm not because it's not going to be sort of Missy Starling the novel,
right?
Which I'm hoping is okay with and, somebody.
And can you briefly describe what it's about?
Oh, wouldn't that be good if I could?
Oh.
Wouldn't that be great?
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be a really useful skill?
This is your pitch. What's it called?
The tagline.
Or the log line. What's it called?
Tagline, isn't it?
I used to know this.
Logline is screenplays, isn't it?
Yeah, there's that thing you have to produce, like
27
words.
Yeah. Mm.
Maybe describing it is like a bit of a big ask at this precise moment. But could you? Is it a similar genre to Missy Starling?
Not
funny.
It is funny. I think it's funny. And again, you know, funny is community. But I think it's. in some ways, it's kind of like, so the original short story is about a couple going on their first holiday together, and how being in a foreign country, out of their kind of usual rhythms, sort of exposes that the things they liked about each other are suddenly reversed and are bringing out like anxieties and sort of ugliness in each other, and this lack of control, because it's kind of it's about a couple where there's an age difference and a financial difference and a class difference, and that all gets sort of pulled to the fore. And the novel as a whole is kind of like a three-part question of, is there a way of them making it work as they become different people over the course of about 5 years? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's kind of about like actually how difficult it is to... to love someone, I suppose, especially when humans as individuals are so messy. Mm-hmm. And it's, I suppose it's also about like just kind of this background of panic that just seems to run through the world.
Yeah.
Of just, and so how do you make a commitment to anyone? How do you make a commitment to anything when it feels like you are just on the edge of a precipice at all times?
That sounds... I want to read it.
Already, yeah, I want to read that. It sounds prescient.
Yeah. It also sounds like it's people, a bit like Missy Starling, it's like people grappling with the difference between the narrative they've built in their head, maybe about their lover or themselves, versus the reality that hits them when everything is kind of exposed.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's... And I'm a big one of... it's something that I talk about with my older sister. She says a lot of kind of, well, I think this is what's going on, but maybe that's just the story I'm telling myself. And in some ways, like, that's all life is and all we are is just the story we're telling ourselves.
Yeah.
But then it's one of those things of, particularly, I think, people in... I think it happens to everyone, but I think people in creative fields are much more conscious of themselves doing it, of constructing these narratives and telling themselves a story. And it's like, do I think that's the case, or would it just have narrative satisfaction to it if that was the case?
These are big questions. I wish I had the answer to all of them. But actually, I would like to loop back on something you said a few minutes ago about the fact that having won a short story prize has attracted agents. Could you talk a little bit about what it's like to win the competition and the wake of that?
Yeah. I mean, it was very exciting. I came with just no expectations. I mean, I think it did help that I'd done like a workshop thing that Huma Qureshi had led, where she just mentioned as a throwaway thing that she'd been shortlisted for the Brick Lane Bookshop Prize. And I can't remember if I'd been shortlisted at that point or not, but I just remember that thing of like, well, if I can just get shortlisted, it seems to work trying for her. So in some ways that sort of took the pressure off of, I just came with no expectations because I was like, well, already something very nice has happened. And then listening to it, I just kept thinking, oh, well, that's going to win. And well, that's going to win. Because I thought the other stories were brilliant. And I also thought they were quite different to what I'd done, mm-hmm. which just made me think, well, if that's what they like, then maybe they don't like what I did. yeah. And then afterwards, you know, getting to talk to Chris Welbelove was very cool. And
Chris Welbelove is the agent who was the judge last year, by the way. Yeah. For listeners who
sorry,
aren't clued like, up about the competition.
Chris Welbelove, everyone knows Chris Welbelove.
yeah, and then sorry, it feels weird to talk about. It feels like jinxy or something. But yeah, and then a little while later, I heard from someone from Mushin's Entertainment, which again was very cool. And it's just nice when people have read something that you sort of, you start off thinking only I am going to care about this. And so it's very nice when other people like it and when, you know, people like agents are interested and think what you're doing is interesting and, you know, want to read more. And yeah, and obviously it's a much nicer position to be in than a lot of people who are having to approach agents for the first time and just have no context of, are you going to like what I'm doing? And how do I write an email that I think you might want to read? And, you know, that kind of thing is very daunting, I think. So honestly, I do recommend entering short story prizes.
So just coming off that, what advice would you give to people who are thinking about entering the Brick Lane Bookshop Short Story Prize?
We should say actually that when this podcast goes out, there's going to be about a week left until the Short Story Prize deadline.
Deadline?
Oh. Yeah.
Is it open now, is it?
It's going to open, but by the time this goes out, it will be open.
Okay. Yeah. And then a week left until it closes.
Yeah.
Right. Oh, God.
Okay.
Get your interview now, so, guys.
You know, any valuable advice?
But. I mean, honestly, I'm a complete like evangelist for this. I'd go door to door. But reading George Saunders' A Swim in a Pond in the Rain, or whatever it's called. Mm-hmm.
I think that's it. Swim in the Pond in the Rain.
Okay. I do think that must be like the plague of booksellers everywhere. You know, when people come in and it's like, oh, well, it's got a green cover and I think it's got the word juice in it. And you've got to put that together. And
sometimes you can.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just look blank.
Yeah. But I feel like that must be a real one of like, yeah, I've come for the swimming in the duck pond with the Russians.
But that would be quite a good description, actually.
Yes.
But anyway.
But yeah, but I just think it's brilliant, not just in terms of having really like great advice, much better advice than I could ever give anyone, but also I've never read something about writing that just so completely makes me want to start writing again. You know, you read a couple of pages, and I've got to put this down because I need to write something. I need to, you know, put pen to paper. And I really like what he says about, I can't remember the exact words, but something about having like your own personal pile of shit. Or your own personal molehill or whatever. And it's like, and this is mine and I will defend it. And I really like that of not worrying about, am I suppose, yeah, exactly what I was doing at the launch of just thinking, well, I don't write like these people. So I must have been doing something wrong. And actually it's like, no one's doing anything wrong. It's just, it's finding your pile of shit.
I think if you're not writing like anybody else, you found something wonderful. I think that,
yeah.
Like, having read lots and lots of short stories now, I think when you find something that's truly unique and truly different, like this story is, you're just like, oh, this is good. This it does something to your brain, gives you a little fuzzy thing in your brain where you're like, oh, I'm learning something new. I'm having a new experience here.
And that, yeah.
But so then, hold on to that feeling. Yeah. Sure.
But then I don't want to kind of knock imitation as an exercise, I suppose, because it's something that Amy Mann talks about in her podcast, which I can't remember the name of, but I was raised by Amy Mann. And I love her. And she talks about how actually trying to do something, whether it's songwriting for her or writing short stories or novels like somebody else, is actually a useful exercise in just picking up other people's tools and finding what works for you. Because even when you're imitating someone, you're not going to be writing like them. You're always going to be bringing your flavor to whatever you're doing. And I think that's really important. And it was also something that Ross Raisin said in a workshop where he was talking about, he was sort of asking us about voice, like author voice, and he's thinking, who do you think has an authorial voice that stays the same through everything that they write? And it's basically no one. Like, even if they have a distinctive voice, it's still going to be ultimately the novel's voice. It's going to belong to whatever story they're telling. So yeah, basically I don't knock imitation, but I also don't think that we should be trying to emulate other people like it's the only path. I feel like we have to kind of play in a lot of different sandboxes and we'll just take what fits.
I think that's fine advice. Yeah, play. I think play is the key, isn't it?
Yeah.
Just got to enjoy it and write lots and see where the shit pile lands.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, yeah, basically it has to be fun. It has to be something that you care about, whether it's making you laugh or it's, you know, picking at something that's been niggling your brain. It's all useful and it's all going to teach you something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, there's the old cliche, isn't it, that no writing is wasted.
Yeah.
You know, but I think it's true. You know, you have to get something out of your head to understand how to look at it from outside.
Yeah. No, definitely. Yeah. I mean, it's like a friend of mine has been, has just shifted her novel from switching persons to just being from one character's point of view. And she was kind of a little bit reluctant to do that, even though it's what she wanted to do. That sort of part of her is like, but I've done all of this stuff in learning about all these other characters. And I was like, that is amazing. Hardly any novelist is coming in there knowing what's going on in all the other characters' heads. You know, you've given yourself a gift of like a really rich tapestry for your story to exist in because you know so much about everybody else. Whereas most of the time when I'm writing, it's like, well, there's a rough sort of stick figure over in that corner and I'll fill it in later.
I think everyone reaches their stories at different stages, don't they?
Yeah.
It's tricky. I'm going to end with the question I ask everyone at the end, and you've answered a lot of the question already, I think, but who are you reading now? Who or what are you reading now? And are there writers or particular books that you always return to?
So at the minute, what I've been reading, I was reading Mary Gateskill before I came here. Yeah. Ooh, my first time.
Really? How did you find her?
I really like it. I just love how specific it feels. It's, again, it's someone who's found their own pile of shit.
And she really has.
Yeah.
Quite grubby shit.
Yeah. So yeah, that's great. I've just been pushing a friend of mine to get Great Circle by Maggie Shipstead, which I loved. I thought it was brilliant, just the scope of it and the specificity of it. Yeah, I think that's... Oh, and I'm also like a sucker for a good biography. Ever since I got onto Claire Tomlin, I've read almost everything Claire Tomlin's ever written now, because I got on a real kick of just reading all of her different. I started with her Thomas Hardy, and I think ended with her Mary Wollstonecraft or something. But I just finished a biography of Vera Nabokov, so Vladimir's wife, by Stacey Schiff. Which is just fascinating. There's a weird couple.
I bet, yeah.
They shared a diary.
Ooh.
What?
They shared a diary.
Is that available to read?
The diary, I don't know. Well, that's the other interesting thing about her is that she has like, it's not like one of those women in the background who never got their due. It's like she has systematically erased herself from his story, you know, and she died after him and could have done different and didn't. You know, she wanted it to be this way. So that's very interesting.
That's fascinating.
Shared diary.
Yeah.
That's intense.
And there's like letters where he's writing to someone saying, yeah, I'm sorry this is in pencil. Vera's got the pen. And it's like, is there only one pen? And in terms of books that I return to, it's got to be Persuasion by Jane Austen. I And this is partly just I'm the middle of three daughters. And it always used to bother me reading fairy stories as a child where, like, the youngest is always the one who gets the adventure. She's always the perfect one that everything happens to. And the middle one is always just the sidekick of the evil older sister. Except for in 12 Dancing Princesses, it's the eldest who gets a look in. And I was just like, there's no fairy stories where the middle one gets anything to do and it's about her. And so in some ways, Persuasion is just, it's my fairy story that wasn't in my childhood. It's the middle of three daughters and it's about her. And there is something sort of fairy tale-esque, I think, about Persuasion. But also I love the comedy of it, of Sir Walter Elliot and I love Mary, her younger sister. Just you know, you've come to visit me when I'm so ill. And no one cares. So I enjoy it a lot. And so I do just every few years come back to it.
I should probably not admit that I've not read it, but now I want to.
Okay. I think we've come to the end.
I think we have. Thank you very much, Imogen Fox, for joining us here.
Well, thanks for having me.
Cool. Absolute pleasure.
And we wish you the best of luck with your novel that will hopefully come out in a couple of years' time, because it will take that long. But any agents listening, open your mail. See if there's something from Imogen Fox. Should be
yes,
there
please.
Now.
Chris, open your email.
Oh, this is how it works.
Yeah.
Oh, fascinating.
Very nepotistic. Great. No, but thank you very much for coming on the podcast, and we wish you the very best of luck.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to the B&B podcast. Please remember to rate and review us. We'd love to hear what you think of the show. You can get in touch on social media via @BrickLaneBooks or email us at inquiries@BrickLaneBookshop.org. The music, as ever, is by Andrew Everett. Andrew is also a bookseller at Brick Lane Bookshop, and we'd like to thank him for allowing us to use a section of his beautiful track, Can't Have Everything, for the show. If you like his music as much as we do, you can find more on andreweverett.bandcamp.com.